Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
Inside my house, patriarchs are sleeping.
This is really good, this stuff. I mean, this guy's gorgeous baritone voice. Yeah.
The singer here is Robert Swenson, who's a tenor, actually, but the part of the recording we're listening to, he's singing in a very deep, rich baritone range. What we're listening to is the Tin Angel Opera, which is by Daniel Asia, with a libretto by Paul Pines. And this is actually something that's in development right now with the Center for Contemporary Opera. And you can go and see it while it's still being worked on April 21st and 22nd at the Cell Theater. And if you go to the website, we'll have a link to where you can buy tickets and all that.
I wonder how long they've been working on it.
I don't know.
Because sometimes, you know, things can get workshopped for anywhere from 6 months to, you know, 2 years to sometimes, you know, you always hear those nightmare stories of workshopping for 5 years.
Well, it's kind of cool. With a project like this, you can actually see it in development grow up in front of your eyes. And it costs just as much as going to see.
Yeah.
You should go and see it 2 or 3 times and see how it's changed.
It's also, I think you listen differently when you're able to hear very short sections, you know, of music. And then they stop all the time. And then you get to hear things repeated. And it gets, you can listen and kind of get into the work a little bit better if you're hearing it in rehearsal. I always thought so.
They haven't nailed down dates for the final opening of the opera. It's been completely written, but the parts are showing at the Center for Contemporary Opera in April. They're going to just be doing 1.5 acts. Later in the podcast, we have a discussion with Lawrence Harris, and we get to hear him sing some amazing...
A whole bunch of Tosti songs. Actually, he's an opera singer who's not singing opera right now, but he's...
You'd call it art song, right?
Art song, right, yeah, or, you know, Neapolitan song.
Neapolitan song, yeah. And, hey, this guy is great.
Listen
to this.
Non senti tu nell'aria il profumo che spande primavera, non senti tu nell'anima il suon di nuova voce lusinghiera.
He has an amazing voice, and it's a wonderful interview, so we'll have that later. Let's actually talk a little bit about our mailbag.
Okay.
We got some really great feedback. There's some really constructive feedback from people about the volume levels.
Yeah, we're working on it. We're working on the volume levels.
We'll see if this one's any better.
Yeah. Maybe we should mention this is the first podcast we're doing via Skype. So
yeah,
we'll see how that works out. See if you can tell the difference.
And then we have, we got a really good feedback from someone named Suzanne Rossini, who actually says she wanted to hear more about Hannah Lash's talking about the sort of the symbolism and things. We actually had a lot more in that Hannah Lash interview. I really was merciless when I edited that down.
Yeah, we might have to release it maybe a little bit.
Why don't we do it next week? We'll put out the entire
interview by itself. Yeah, okay. Definitely.
And that'll be for like people who are interested in opera geeks, because she gets into some really cool technical stuff about microtonal things and also the chord structure that she uses for the opera.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting to just even hear her talk. Unfortunately, I should have made it clear last podcast that the microtonal stuff is just a class that she's teaching right now, and actually the opera she's premiering is not a microtonal work. But it still was, you know, it's fascinating to hear her talk about her developing her tools, and it's just good stuff.
Yeah, so we'll release that whole thing and maybe a little more of her music.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so now let's talk a little bit about some of the things we saw recently. Noah and I went to Galapagos Space to see Opera Grows in Brooklyn. It's part of the Opera on Tap series, which you may have heard of, that happens in Brooklyn at bars periodically, and also the American Opera Projects. And they did an evening on March 27th of all women's composers' operas. They did 3 of them.
Yeah, they called it Ladies' Night, which was a great idea.
It was actually an incredible time. It was fun. There was great people. I love the space.
I love the space. Even before we, I was going to say, before we start talking about the works, the space is, has got water and reflective pools and just cut out seating. It's incredible. It's you got to go just for the space. You
know? Yeah, it was unbelievable. And it's a really a great way to see opera, you know, mm-hmm. seeing something that intimate, you're up close and you get to drink.
Always a plus. Also, it felt like anybody could have performed there. Like a rock band could have been there, or an electronica group could have done. I mean, anybody. It felt like it could have performed in that space.
Yeah, and actually, they do that. And there's also they send us pictures. I'll post that on the website. They send us pictures of weddings and
weddings. I didn't know that. Really,
that'd be cool.
Whoa, what a cool place. Yeah,
great place to have a wedding.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the things we saw. The first thing we saw was Miranda. And how do we describe Miranda? Miranda was sort of a reality television murder mystery.
Yeah, and it was really multimedia. It started with a projection. It kind of set the story up more or less like a mystery, yeah. I remember. You know, like a whodunit kind of.
Yeah, and things like, you decide.
Yeah, that's right.
It was actually kind of cool. And it felt a little bit like, do you know Lifetime TV have those mysteries? What were they called? It's not Look Who I Found in a Ditch. What was it called? Yeah, I don't know what it is.
I thought Lifetime was always when they had like the, and then they have like some woman you've never heard of story, like the Janet Storker story.
Yeah.
You know, like the woman who fell on a rake, the Janet Storker story. No, isn't that usually Lifetime?
Yeah, I don't know why they think women's entertainment has to be like murder and how I was beaten by, you know, my best friend or.
Yeah. But we're watching it though. That's the funny part.
So this opera is sort of has a good sense of humor like that as well. You know, it was a work in progress, so we're not going to actually review it. It's not sort of fair to do that.
No, I mean, it's a really interesting work. It's just you can see what she's striving for.
Right.
And what she's striving for is so interesting. I mean, she mixes an electronic and electroacoustic sounds, and that was incredible. And the fact that each of the performers, each of the players, you know, on stage playing the instruments, got up at one point and sang and acted.
They're
and
part of it, yeah.
Really now, bending the boundaries of the genre. You know?
Yeah, and we should mention her name. Her name is Kamala Sankaram.
Mm-hmm.
She actually sang.
She's a singer, yeah, which is an interesting thing. Yeah.
And it had a really nice aesthetic. I mean, I really like it. I don't know, what would you call that? Sort of.
A little bit like Bjork, a little bit. I mean, she herself mentioned a likeness to Bjork, and I heard that. It's hard to make comparisons.
Yeah.
Because it's so new.
Yeah, and she mentioned having like a Hindustani classical music, you know, influence, a Baroque. And I felt a sort of a minimalist pop.
Definitely.
Yeah, it was really
definitely.
Great.
It's a mix. It's a real mix of things and eclectic.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see what it's going to turn into. It looks like it's going to be fun. All right, let's talk about the second project.
Yeah, well, this was an interesting work.
I'm amazed because I knew nothing about this. And this is actually different than the other two in that it was a fully developed work that had been performed at the Lincoln Center Festival in 1998. So it actually sort of had a performance history. And this was doing a small part of it with just piano and two singers.
Yeah, they tried to give you... I don't know, like a tour through the opera. There was something from the first act, something from the second act, something from the third act.
And the opera is called Patience and Sarah. Music by Paula Kemper, libretto by Wendy Persons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on a novel by Isabel Miller. And it's about...
From like 19th century, right?
Yeah.
It's an old, yeah.
It's from... It's set in 1816. And it's a story of two women, lesbians, who decide that they don't like where they're living and they strike out west and start their life...
And one of the women wants to pass, I think, as a man, or does pass as a man,
and
which is an interesting thing. Yeah,
and they want to live by their own rules, and the whole sort of gay coming out story, you know, now, it feels a little like, you know, after school specials.
Yeah, after school specials, yeah. Except I didn't think of it so much as a coming out story as just a plain old love story.
Yeah, and it,
you know.
And it was funny because the women kiss a lot on stage. Somehow, seeing two women kissing in an opera was a little like...
Shocking?
It was so different for me. You know?
Yeah, like, I guess I can't think of another...
I've never...
...show where women kiss. If anybody can, send it in.
Well, not... Yeah, exactly. But it was kind of interesting. It made me go, gosh, why is this so unusual to me? It shouldn't be, you know?
Yeah, but I guess it's not something we see a lot, so...
Yeah. And there was some serious singing there.
There was some serious. Both of the singers were incredible. There was a mezzo and a soprano voice.
Yeah.
Just incredible singers. Do we have their names?
Yeah, there? I do. It's Rosalie Sullivan was the mezzo. She was incredible.
Oh, she was, yeah.
Adrian Dandrish played was the soprano, and they were just amazing.
Good. And the music is, I don't know, what would you say? It's very... diatonic, you know, very tonal and very comfortable. There's dissonance, but it's always resolved, I think, and it's very, it sounds a little bit like Americana music to me, but yeah. done really well.
Yeah. I mean, it had a sort of a Aaron Copland Americana open, yeah. you know, feeling, but, you know, they are talking about the prairies.
Yeah, and I'm always, like, suspicious of that kind of music because it can be really schlocky, but it wasn't at all.
No, I thought
it was really beautiful, yeah.
It actually sounded really refined, and there's something about the music that gave it a scale. Like, it felt like this was a grand opera.
Yeah. It's funny that the sound of an opera can kind of indicate the space it should be in.
Yeah.
You know? There's something about that that's interesting.
Yeah, the Miranda piece felt like it was a smaller stage piece.
Right, like it fit the venue.
Yeah, and the Patience and Sarah was like, you need an orchestra and you need big sets.
Yes, big singers like they had. Big sets, that's right, yeah. Rolling tumbleweeds and things like that.
Exactly. And then the third piece we saw was, it's called Prairie Dogs, but actually that isn't the whole opera, is it?
No, I think it's it's a triptych is what she called it. And a triptych is, you know, anything. Well, it comes from religious art, but it's usually any kind of stage work that has three parts that aren't necessarily connected,
right.
except they're placed next to each other.
And I think the larger piece is called The Wild Beast of the Bungalow.
Right, which just has an interesting title, yeah.
The first piece, which we didn't see, is something to do with a mermaid.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that unites the three pieces, there's an 11-year-old girl character that's in all three pieces. And this piece, the Prairie Dog piece, is inspired by a true story.
See, I was totally wild about it. I liked this one the best out of the three. I just thought it was great and funny, and I didn't expect it to go where it went. You know, it was like kind of, I mean, we were talking about, remember we talked about, can opera be funny?
Yeah,
this was it. We were laughing at this.
It was great.
Like, really laughing, yeah.
The story that inspired it, there was a town, apparently, somewhere in Alberta, Canada, and they had a problem with prairie dogs. They didn't know what to do, so, and this is a true story, they started killing these prairie dogs and then stuffing them and making a gopher hole museum. And they would make little dioramas of the prairie dogs, you know, like a prairie dog fire station, a prairie dog town hall.
Just anthropomorphizing them, making them...
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
And so the story of this one is a gopher family that doesn't want to be stuffed. It's sort of like, we're trying to stay under the radar. And this 11-year-old girl says, I want you to adopt me.
And there was, oh man, it was just so kind of rich. And like, it's something you have to see a few times. Because when you see it, you're not sure what you're watching. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're never sure what you're watching, but it's great.
And the family adopts her, and she makes them sign a contract. And
she
decides that, you know, in the contract, there's a codicil that says, I decide what we watch on TV.
Right. And then isn't there a fight about, you have a gay friend, now I have a gay friend too?
Yeah, well,
remember that part?
One of the gophers has a pet rock. A pet rock.
Yes.
That the girl says, you have to name him Rock Hudson. And he'll be your gay friend, like my gay friend. And she has a gay friend, too, who's a gay prairie dog.
Yeah, of course.
Who's absolutely hysterical. I mean, really, I just love this piece. I cannot wait to see it when it's fully developed and to see the whole thing. Now let's... Oh, we didn't give any credits here. The music's by Rachel Peters, and the libretto is by Royce Vavrick.
Yeah, I see his name a lot all over the place now. It's how I can tell, you know.
He's actually... two of the Vox operas this year that are being done in May, he was a librettist for.
Yeah.
So he's out there. He's doing some really cool stuff. And this libretto, I mean, it was...
I think when I was younger and I was getting into opera, libretto is something I always undervalued. Like, now you just see how it makes the work. It really does, you know?
Absolutely.
And a good libretto.
Yeah, you need someone who's a dramatist as well, you know,
and definitely.
A sense of humor. In,
not just like, a poet, not just a, yeah.
In this case, a sense of humor really was also a driving force. Okay, so let's talk about the other thing that you saw at City Opera recently.
Ah, the monodramas.
Yeah, tell me about
it. Okay, so the monodramas was something I was really excited about seeing. I was disappointed that they only had three dates for this because it's three works all featuring solo female voices. And they're really rare works. Like, one of them is by John Zorn called La Machine de Lettres, which means the machine of being, I think. And it was just incredible lights and projections and fire on stage and burning. What do they call that stuff when they burn
flash paper
that comes, that's really shocking and exciting. It was a cool work. It was inspired by Artaud. You know, any of Artaud's stuff? He's like, he was a dramatic writer and thinker and kind of wild guy who wrote really crazy stuff about the theater, and you could see that it was kind of dealing with his ideas a little bit.
Was there a plot?
No, it's his, Zorn's works are very playful. You know, this is a guy who writes musical games, comes up with musical games, and comes up with different ways of putting sounds together. And it seems like any kind of plot, at least how we use that word, would be something he always kind of avoids. And you could tell in this work. But you didn't feel like it was too long. It was a short work. You know, you were able to sit with it. I was able to sit with it. I really liked it. And the second thing we saw before there was a short intermission was Schoenberg's Erwartung, which is an incredible work. And just, I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. It's this big, sprawling, difficult atonal work, but it's not 12-tone. It's not like something where you can go and analyze it and figure out exactly what he's doing. It's really intuitive and
was this notes something early? Was this an What's early that? Early work?
This is during his kind of middle intuitive atonal period before he got real strict with the 12-tone system.
Yeah, now Schoenberg is going to come up a few times, I'm sure, in our podcast, because he really took music to this whole other place where it went beyond tonality. It almost turned into code and all sorts of cool things. Some people actually really hate his work.
Yes, people are really divided on music of the 20th century and 21st century in general, but I think nowhere do people come to blows more often than when it comes to the subject of atonality. You know, it's just, people love to hate it. Well, the Erwartung has a real clear narrative, right? I mean, it's a little bit misty, it's a little bit vague, but basically there's a woman and she's lost and she's looking for her lover and she thinks she finds his body, but then it's really just a tree. And, you know, it's just this simple idea of her waiting and you not knowing really anything about her, except she's freaked out and she's full of anxiety. And you watch it happen and you watch her be freaked out, you know, so
like a nightmare.
It's like a nightmare. It's very much like a nightmare. And then there was a short intermission and a work called Neither by Morton Feldman, another composer people love to hate because his works are just so challenging. This piece was an hour long. And the poetry was by Samuel Beckett, playwright Samuel Beckett.
Of course.
It was written specifically for this collaboration. And I really liked it, but I just think if you hated it, if you saw it and you thought it was too long or you thought it was pretentious, you know, that makes sense to me. It's a really hard work, you know? I mean, I thought it was great. The thing about Feldman that's so interesting is he just destabilizes your sense of time. It's hard to tell how long something's going on for, because there's always this kind of repetition going on, but the pattern is never, it's always a little bit like an idling kind of thing.
Right.
And that really, that makes people angry.
Yeah, you know, there's sort of that whole trend where music became like meditation, where you disassociate with time and your brain sort of wanders. Became a big thing for a while. And
you can do it with this piece. It's really enjoyable. But I think I talked to some people who just thought, no way, this is like painful. But I gotta say one more thing. The production was incredible. I mean, the lights and shiny stuff and just, I mean, we were talking about Cirque du Soleil, and I have not seen a Cirque du Soleil show, but I would put this up to the visual test with Cirque du Soleil, even having not seen it. I just thought it was stunning. I've rarely been that impressed with visuals in any opera production.
So City Opera's going all out.
Well, with this they did. At least they made it look like they're going all out with this.
Was the house foolish, emptyish?
I was going to say, the crowd for this was, I always love the crowd for these kind of works because it's a real mix of people. You know, you see all sorts of, you know, grungy hipsters and people with beards and people in leather. I mean, you see every sort of interesting person come out for these things, and this was no different. So I think it was pretty packed,
right.
And it was also a very mixed crowd, you know, which was exciting.
All right.
So we got an email, right, from this singer, Lawrence Harris.
Yeah, he actually found us, which I was shocked. He actually emailed us very soon after. He was in the New York Times on March 16th. They had an article. It's actually mostly about him, but it's about opera singers who started out their lives and careers as football players and then turned into opera singers later.
And we were talking about how, you know, there's so many connections. I mean, there's a lot of people I know, and you, a lot of people you know, who have previous careers in, sometimes in sports, sometimes in medicine, and, you know, make a switch for whatever reason. In this case, he was injured, right? His back was injured.
Well, yeah, but also the average, we'll have him say this, but the average career is only 4 years. So you
have it's very short. It's like being a dancer.
You have to do something after.
Yeah. but he's got an incredible voice. Should we play just a little bit of his singing?
Sure, let's listen. Okay. Before we play the interview with Larry Harris, I'd like to explain a technical term that comes up in the discussion. We use the word passaggio. Basically, it's a spot in the voice where your voice changes from its very resonant, deep, low area that sometimes people call the chest voice, and then there's a high area they call the head voice. A lot of singers work very hard to cover that so that there's no crack. It's where the voice often cracks when you're starting to move up higher. Anyway, hopefully that helps. So tell us a little bit about your career here. Did you study before becoming a football player?
I did. I studied in my undergraduate work,
and
Oklahoma and other places.
And did you think, oh, gee, you know, this football career isn't going to last forever, and that's why you're doing it, or just doing it for the pure fun?
Probably it was just in my blood, and so it was for fun. I loved it. And
is it in your family at all?
It is. It was in my family. I grew up around gospel singers. And the Met broadcast came to me on my little radio in my closet. No one else in my family really knew what I was doing or knew anything about me and my opera fantasies.
Do you remember the first work you got hooked by, or the first aria?
Trovatore was the first work, and because I was particularly interested in all the sword fighting and the guys, you know, in armor and the witches and all that. And it was a heartbreaking story, you know, when the witch threw her baby in the fire and all that. And so it kind of touched me in a lot of different ways at a young age.
So you had to hide it?
I kind of felt like I did have to hide it, because in my family, gospel singing and football.
Huh.
So it really didn't fit into my world.
That was in Texas?
In Texas. Small town in North Texas, Sherman.
Football's a little bit different. Careers are short.
True.
So
what's the average career, you'd say, for a football player?
4 years.
Wow. It's like a dancer's career.
And did they pay you when you're on the injured list, or?
Yeah, I got paid an injured salary. It's a different compensation, and of course, it's all changed in we say audible in football, so it's all audibled, sort of manufactured and tailored to how the team sees fit to use you at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the back of your mind, while you were playing, and since you know you'd have a short career, were you thinking, oh, I have opera in the back pocket, or did opera sort of become a surprise career for you?
It was always in there, and from my childhood, but it never really came to me until one season I was working in the oil field to stay in shape, and I was out on a rig in the Gulf of Mexico. And I happened to be on the top of a derrick. That was my job at the time. And we were fighting a blowout. It was not at a very dangerous state at that time. So we were just fighting it by adding heavy material to the drilling fluid. Mm-hmm. And that's a 24-hour process. So I was just up there on the top of the derrick, 300 feet up above anything. And I began to sing again. And so when I, at some point, I said, man, you know, this is something I really should go back to. And the very next season I hurt my back, and so, you know, I had to retire, and so it wasn't an easy transition. Mm-hmm. I mean, how could it be, right? It was a kind of a natural transition.
Yeah,
I fought it, but it was there for me.
Did you move to the city for that reason, or was there another reason to come towards New York?
I did take part in some young artist programs around the Midwest and out in California, but the Metropolitan Opera was interested in my talent, and they brought me up here to stay with some of their people. At the time, since I was in another career, they couldn't offer me the Young Artist Program. Mm-hmm. But through the National Council, they were able to fund much of my training, and I segued into Manhattan School of Music and then on into some other programs.
Who are your mentors? Who did you stay with?
Boy, that's hard. But I would say when I first moved to New York, I had the privilege of working with Jerome Hines and Franco Corelli. And they encouraged me immensely. At the time, the Metropolitan Opera was really high on my voice, and they heard height as well as depth in my voice. So they were thinking of putting me on a backup situation for the other Helden tenors that they had in the time, Timothy Jenkins and Gary Lakes and those guys.
I was going to ask.
And they were football players, right?
Who Gary Lakes was,
yeah.
I read that.
And Jenkins was another football player from Texas. So I guess somehow it made sense to them that I come in as another football player and you know, back up the other guys.
Yeah, so, that's
just
funny.
Like the old team.
Yeah, so
I was going to ask you about the tenor transition. You started as a tenor.
I started as a baritone. That was my voice. But at some point, there were a few choice people at the Met that thought I would, you know, since I had the height in my voice, I have a natural. So they said, well, let's do that. But as you all know, the passaggio lies differently for the baritone. So it was a much more natural for me to sing the baritone repertoire.
Where would you say your passaggio is? Like, which notes?
Between E natural, mm-hmm, D flat, E natural right there.
Okay. Because that's a common thing I find in Helden tenors, that their break seems to be a little bit lower.
I know.
You know, like, you know, those tenors who can keep it open up to G sharp,
exactly,
and things like that. That's
exactly,
you know, different voices almost.
Yeah. So for me, I was opening, you know, when I should have been closing, and vice versa.
So what sort of resonates for you now? What is the stuff that you love singing?
I love singing Rigoletto. Mm. I love singing Scarpia. Germain is a wonderful role. Presently, I'm working on a Tosti album with VAI recording label, and I want to make sure that my whole soul goes into that at the moment. And it's a beautiful group of songs that I'm so blessed to be a part of that.
What sort of training or what sort of theatrical experience do you have, and what do you, is there something specifically about acting and singing that you like, or is it just the singing?
I enjoy most of all communicating another person's ideas. Maybe I feel more comfortable doing that. but it's a nice place to be able to communicate someone else's creation. And I think the challenge is just to bring not myself into it, but I think the challenge is to bring it forth in such a way that it can seem more interesting and more fresh for the listener.
It sounds like you have to take risks. And actually, both careers you've had to take risks. Is it the same height? Is it as scary? Or is this just a different kind of risk?
Well, I'm without a doubt, I'm going to say that singing is a much more dangerous place to be.
Wow.
You know? Physically, come on, you wear pads, you wear armor when you play football, and you're going to get hurt. Opera is something that can affect you and can hurt you and can scare the bejesus out of you to the very core of what you are as a human being. And you're so exposed, and it takes you from one end of the spectrum to the other. And you can enter that arena in that fashion. I always like to say that before I begin something that, you know, singing is a celebration of humanity in every way, because the human voice is unique in that way. I approach that in that mode of giving thanks and giving, you know, being thankful for just who I am and what I have. But the other end of the spectrum of that is, you know, waking up every day and the insecurity of knowing I'm an American singing in a foreign language. And you know, having to constantly know that I have to prove myself. And I don't have, you know, 10 other people beside me taking up the slack. It's just me. So yeah, there's a lot of different emotions involved in this, but I would say it's really taking a risk a lot more than being on a playing field with a team. And you know, in football you get instant gratification every time you go out and you make, you know, a good play or a good, you know, you don't get that when you're working in a room with just yourself and a piano. Renee, my wife, mentioned earlier that we touched someone as we were performing earlier and they were brought to tears outside the hall. We recently performed this Tulsa music in Texas, and I did notice that this gentleman reached over and touched his wife's hand, and we found out later that he had Alzheimer's for over 10 years, and he hadn't even reached out to touch her in all that time, and something within the Tulsa music brought that out of him.
Yeah.
And she was in tears, and he reached out and touched her. You can't measure that. You can't measure that at all.
Yeah.
It's a profound experience. That this kind of this art, you know, brings, that we're happy to be a part of. We're thankful to be a part of it, you know, all of us. So
let's play some more so you can hear Lawrence singing.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you. Thanks for
thanks for coming.
Thank you, Noel. Thank you, Peter.
Avrai sul petto rose cilestrine, e le farfalle candide talleggeranno intorno a nero crine. E pietra avrai fra mammole, avrai sul petto rose cilestrine, le farfalle candide galleggeranno intorno al nero crine.
I guess that's everything for this week from Indie Opera Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for listening. And why don't we exit the podcast with a little more of Larry Harris singing?
Definitely.
Great. See you
all
next
right.
time.
Bye.
Per noi appena
The Indie Opera Podcast was recorded by Noah Lethbridge and me, Peter Zepp, and this week I edit the program. We'd like to thank Rachel Harris for her wonderful piano playing with Larry Harris. It was gorgeous. And we'd like to thank the Westminster Conservatory of Music, where we recorded Larry Harris. Thank you.